Thanks so much for joining us on Better Beyond 50, where we talk about simple diet and lifestyle tips and strategies to make the second phase of your life the best years of your life. If you haven't already, make sure you check out my free video training where I give you a 6-step plan to create vibrant health after 50. Just head on over to betterbeyond50.com, enter your email, and you'll get instant access to my free training. Today, I am talking with clinical nutritionist and traditional naturopath David Getoff, and we're going to talk about the ideal human diet, what foods we should be eating and avoiding to feel our healthiest. Hello, David.
Hello there. I am ready to teach as many people as we can all the things that they wish they had known before.
Yeah, I love it. This is the fourth time I've interviewed you, and we have a couple more interviews scheduled because I love talking with you. You're a wealth of knowledge. We just actually launched our first podcast this week. You were our very first guest that we featured, and people loved it. I mean, many of our listeners, we talked about cholesterol. That was one of the first interviews that we did, and like their minds were blown. Many people are like, wow. So it was really valuable information, and I'm truly honored to be able to talk to you again, because you always sort of leave me feeling like, wow, I learned something new every time I talk to you. So it's not only educational for our audience, but it's educational for me too. So thank you so much for being here.
No, you're very, very welcome. My pleasure. It doesn't really amaze me anymore after 25 years, but the amount of things that the public thinks they know, but what they know is wrong, is absolutely astronomical. And of course, part of that is because the doctors and the dietitians have all been taught it wrong, and those are the ones that are relaying it incorrectly to the public.
Hey, that's why we do these shows, because our listeners want to know the truth. So that's what we're here to talk about.
Excellent.
Let's start off by talking about the staples of a healthy diet. Lots of misinformation out there. And I'm hoping we can kind of bust through some of those myths in our call today. But you have a meal plan on your website, which is pretty comprehensive. So I don't expect you to sort of read through that whole thing. But can you kind of just, because if people want to learn more, they can go to your website. But can you kind of just break it down for us? Just what are sort of the main foods that we should be eating? And then what are some of the main foods that we should be avoiding?
Well, the most important thing, which of course people could read a great book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price, which we keep in print at the foundation, is that when Dr. Price traveled around the world looking at people in all sorts of different parts of the world, and therefore different animals were available for them to kill and eat, different fish were available, different birds were available, different plants were available, different weather as far as what would grow, he found that he was able to find, as long as he got off the beaten path and just went to people that were eating the same as their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents had eaten, that they were in basically perfect health and into old age. He didn't see cancer. He didn't see heart disease. He didn't see diabetes. I mean, all these things weren't there. So it's almost what were they eating is sort of without your realizing what question the question you really want to know. And they were eating differently, but there were a couple things that were always the same. Number one, and when I say number one, I don't mean it's the most important. I just have to start somewhere. Number one, all the food that they were eating had been feeding itself. So if they were eating a particular animal that was in their area that they learned how to track and kill to make their tribe healthy and happy, that animal was feeding itself. In other words, nobody was giving it some grains, some corn, some soybeans to get it fat faster. It was eating all the grasses and weeds and things that were in the area, and therefore its meat and all of its fats were the way they're supposed to be, as opposed to what we get now, where almost all the meats that you get in the store, including even the health food stores, was being fed by humans that are trying to fatten it up as fast as possible. And when you do that, all the fatty acids are incorrect. They're different. You have much more of the inflammatory fats and much less of the omega-3 anti-inflammatory fats. So they were all eating, feeding themselves. All the birds were feeding themselves. You can't get chicken today. You can't get turkey today that's feeding itself. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world unless you have your own. And most of the people I know, including my patients that have their own, are still buying chicken feed and throwing it out there because they don't have enough worms or insects in their area because of all our pollution. There isn't enough of whatever greens the birds want to eat. And so once again, we're feeding them. So whatever you're eating, the most able that you are to get those that are feeding themselves, the healthier the food is that you're getting. And therefore, which is very opposite what a lot of people believe, therefore, chicken and turkey is not as healthy as beef and lamb can be, because you cannot get 100% eating what it's supposed to be birds in the United States unless you're a hunter. However, you can get 100% grass-fed beef and 100% grass-fed lamb, where it's just out there on pastures eating what it's supposed to, and it is not being supplemented every day by people throwing a bunch of other stuff out. So that's one thing. Second thing is everything was eaten fresh. We didn't have electricity, so there's no refrigeration, no freezing, no canning. You know, they didn't have canning jars. And so anytime somebody did eat something, they were eating it fairly close to when they had gathered it, picked it, or most often killed it, because gathering and picking would make foods that don't hold you for a long time. And if you all think about it, obviously, since there was no cupboard, there was no refrigerator, there was no freezer, there was no packaged foods, and you therefore had to eat what would otherwise go bad pretty rapidly. And since agriculture actually is fairly new, so if you go back far enough in time, people didn't eat a very large amount of plant-based things because they weren't there. There wasn't any agriculture. It was just whatever was wild. If you eat plant-based foods, which I'm not saying don't eat, they won't hold you for very long, because the part of food which satiates our hunger and holds us for many, many, many hours is called fatty acids. Those are fats and oils. And so if you don't have a high fat quantity in your food, you're going to be hungry very, very quickly, and you don't have a cupboard, you don't have a store, you don't have a refrigerator. So traditionally, and what our DNA is programmed for, was pretty much a high meat, and I'm very vague when I say meat, that includes all animal proteins. So yeah, when I say meat, that includes eggs, that includes birds, it includes fish, it includes, you know, land animals. Those are all meats to me. They're all basically animal proteins. And so people ate predominantly animal type foods because that was what would hold them until the next thing they could catch, and much less vegetation. I'm not saying vegetables are bad for us, but one classification of the foods that grow from the ground seems to be causing a huge amount of problems, and those are any which are high starch, and when we eat more of them than traditionally anybody did. And that's a lot of places where we get into trouble. And the research studies show that if you go back in time, I don't know, I think it's 100 years, 150 years, that the average American ate somewhere between 8 and 10 pounds of sugar a year from all sources altogether. And now that 8 to 10 pounds, depending on the research study, is up to somewhere between 100 and 180 pounds. So sometimes a food couldn't be, oh, that's a horrible food, but the quantity we eat it in has become a horrible food. And grains and beans are part of that, because we basically were designed to eat a fair amount of animal foods because that was the only thing that held us, and we would have all died off otherwise. However, now most people eat a fairly large amount of starch in their diet. And the starch, which the body rapidly turns into sugar, which causes diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and reduces your immune function for 4 to 6 hours after you consume it. The starches and sugars that we eat the most of, obviously you all know what sugars are and what things taste sweet, so we'll say the starches, are a particular couple of vegetables. So corn is mostly starch. All forms of potatoes, regardless of their color, is mostly starch. All the winter squash, the hard-skinned squashes, are mostly starch. So those are things that if we eat a little bit occasionally is fine. You know, if once or twice a month you want a small portion of those, you know, on your plate with everything else, that doesn't usually cause a problem unless you have diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. And then the other area is beans and grains, and the public is being pushed that beans are good for you, whole grains are good for you. Well, whole grains are better than partial grains, you know, like white rice where they've taken all the nutrients off. However, beans and grains are 75 to 80% pure starch. Your body will turn all of that into sugar. Beans are a little better than grains as long as you stay away from the soybean because of its hormonal problems, because beans convert into sugar a little bit more slowly because of their particular amount of fibers and fats. But all the whole grains people are eating lots and lots of, especially since it's not really a whole grain, it's been grounded into a flour first. And if you think about that, you know, if somebody says this is a cat and the cat walks into your room and then somebody else says this is a cat, and it was a cat that was hit by a car and is now dead. No, they're not both cats. So if you take a bowl of whole grains, and if you planted them, they would grow and sprout, and now you grind them into hundreds of millions of little tiny particles, which we call flour, that's no longer a whole grain.
Right.
You couldn't sprout it, you couldn't plant it. That's now a flour. When you do that, you make it so that the body can access the little tiny particles of what we call flour much more rapidly, and your body will turn it into sugar much more rapidly. So I eat very little grain. When I do eat grain, it's generally an heirloom quality organic barley, because barley is the slowest converter into sugar of all the grains. Next best after that would be black or red quinoa or brown teff. And if somebody wants a rice, rices have, you know, a little bit faster conversion, but there is something called Thai, because it's from Thailand, red cargo rice, much heartier rice. But again, people make that the main part of the meal and then have a little bit of meat with it and a little bit of vegetables, and they'd be better off having a bunch of non-starchy vegetables, a good-sized portion of the meat you like best, season best, and very little, if you choose to have any, of the starch food. Whereas in America, you walk into a restaurant and the first thing that the waitress or waiter asks you, in addition to the main dish you've ordered, is what starch do you want? They want to know whether you want rice or rice pilaf, baked potatoes, mashed potatoes, french fries, you know, any of those. And that's all massively starched. So I've come up with my own way of helping me to get what I want at the restaurants, because very often you've all seen restaurants where the menu says, please no exceptions. And I don't want the potatoes or the corn or the rice they're going to offer me. So I don't say that, because then they'll say no exceptions. I say, no, when they ask me what kind of potato I like or what I like rice, actually I'm allergic to potatoes, corn, and rice. And I just say it with a straight face. You know, it's hard not to laugh because I know I'm not allergic. And the wait person looks at me and says, I'm sorry, sir. Can we get you something else? And I go, well, what else do you have? And they'll go over their list, you know, string beans, broccoli, cauliflower. And I'll pick one and I'll say, thank you very much.
That's so great. I love that. Oh, you're making me laugh. I'm crying because I'm laughing so hard.
Really, the only other thing which has nothing to do with food is that when Price was looking at all these different populations, he found that family was much more important than it is today. And that very often you had two or three generations all living together. And now, of course, you know, how quickly can we get grandma and grandpa, you know, somewhere else? And, oh, gee, mom and dad are getting old. Can we get them into a retirement home real quick so they don't bother us?
Yeah.
And family actually has some importance. And when you're looking at, just to help everybody, when you're looking at a diet, and I don't like the word diet, because a diet is defined as a temporary change in eating habits to attain a desired result. So I want people to eat well. I don't want them to diet. One of the things that is an easy way to look at stuff, just to really quickly think about something when you're not listening to me or reading a book, is that there are two important things you can look at. Number one, could somebody have been eating this 1,000 years ago? And number two, are there any populations on the planet Earth that have been eating the way you think is healthy for a minimum of 5 consecutive generations, and the 5th generation still has almost no heart disease, almost no cancer, almost no diabetes, and almost no overweight? Because it takes 5 generations for all of the bad things to start to really get as bad as the improper diet is going to make them. So when somebody points to a diet, a really unhealthy diet, such as strict vegetarianism, otherwise known as vegan, my point is, find me a 5th generation vegan and we'll talk about it. There aren't any. My own personal belief, and I have to admit it's my belief because nobody's ever done this experiment, is that you wouldn't be able to have a 5th generation vegan because the essential nutrients, the essential fatty acids, a couple of which are animal based, the essential vitamins, B12, which if it's not in animal form is very poorly absorbed, there isn't enough, or there aren't enough of them in a vegan diet, and so I believe they would go infertile and die off before we get probably even to the end of the 3rd generation.
Wow. So just to kind of, this is some people listening, like this might be sort of like, I've actually, I'm familiar with nutrition and physical degeneration, And but some people listening to this may be like kind of overwhelmed, like, wow, like this is so far from where I'm eating right now.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So just to kind of recap, I mean, you're basically saying that, you know, based on Weston A. Price's research, you know, we're showing that we ate a very high animal-based diet. The animals that we were eating off the land. You know, they were not being, you know, pumped with hormones and antibiotics and fed, you know, a bunch of grains and soy products like, you know, they're being fed on a lot of industrial farms. And then we sort of had this concept of, you know, families, generations, you know, living together. What if someone is, you know, they want to kind of get closer to that. They want to go back to eating the way that nature intended. And just to kind of recap, eliminating the starches.
Sure.
What's one or two steps or maybe three steps that someone can take? You know, what if they're like way over on the other side and they're like, they're eating a ton of processed foods and they're drinking alcohol, you know, a glass of wine every night. Help them kind of get a little bit closer to the other side without sort of saying, well, you have to like go, you know, so extreme and come way over here. Where can somebody start?
Okay. Well, the first thing I often do, I teach this in my classes, is I have people do their own little 4-day experiment, because when we learn something ourselves, it always ends up being more forcefully and deeply learned than when somebody tells us and we're not sure we believe it. So I'm sure everybody listening to us can accept that if you go back far enough in time, we didn't have refrigerators, we didn't have freezers, we didn't have stores. And so therefore, whatever we ate had to pretty much hold us, maybe even all day long, because we wouldn't have anything else to eat. There were no crops, there was no agriculture, it was just whatever was growing wild. And so our DNA is programmed to be able to have a long distance between meals, because that's what it likes. During that time, it's regenerating and rebuilding, and it doesn't have to divert energy to digestion. So if you eat a meal and you are not able to be totally satiated and not even the least bit hungry or even thinking about food for at least 5 to 7 hours, there was something wrong with that meal. And so I have people do a 4-day experiment. I say take a meal. Most people choose breakfast. It's easier. And pick a food that is animal-based that you like, and that's totally up to you. I don't care if it's leftover beef or lamb or fish or whatever, chicken, you know, anything you want. Most people pick eggs because it's easier. And have an amount of eggs, and for this experiment, I don't care how you prepare them or cook them. You can do whatever you want. Have an amount of eggs that makes you absolutely full. Not like, oh, my God, why did I eat so much? But, you know, nicely full, because nothing else is going to be in this meal. So there isn't going to be a piece of bread. There isn't going to be any potatoes. You're not going to have a glass of juice. It's just going to be eggs. So for most people, if it's a large or extra large egg, that's either 3 or 4 eggs. Some really big people might have to be more. So you have 3 or 4 eggs for breakfast. If you need something to drink, it's a little bit of water, and that's it. And you look at the clock, and you write down what time it is. And then you wait to see, I mean, you're not waiting, you're doing whatever you're doing during the day. But when you first begin to feel slightly hungry, like, you know, I'm starting to get hungry, write down what time it is again and take a look and see how long that's been. And when you're surprised because it's been so many hours longer than you normally go before you get hungry, then do it again tomorrow. So we validate this by doing it or verify it by doing 2 days in a row. Same number of eggs, cooked the same way, and what time did you finish, and what time did you begin to get hungry? So now we've done this 2 days in a row, and you find out for most people, 3 or 4 eggs will hold you somewhere between 5 and 7 hours. Some people it'll hold even longer, but usually it's 5 to 7. And now day 3 and day 4, when you go to show yourself how important this is, that you have eliminated what I call sabotage foods, which are starches, sugars, and alcohols, I want you to have, again, for 2 more days, the exact same meal. I know it's a little bit boring. We're having the same thing for 4 days in a row. But so if you had 4 eggs, you can have 4 eggs again. If they were scrambled, if they were poached, if they were hard-boiled, whatever it is, again, a little bit of water. But you're going to take a food that very often you would have along with your breakfast. So some person might have a piece of 7-grain, multi-grain, organic bread and butter. Somebody else might have some home fries. Somebody else might have a glass of orange juice. I don't care which of those it is. It makes absolutely no difference. But you're going to go ahead and add that, and don't reduce the eggs. Add that to the same, let's say, 3 or 4 eggs you had. And same thing. What time did you finish? Write it down. What time do you get hungry? And you're all going to notice that you have become hungry way earlier, could be hours earlier. Maybe you went 7 hours the first 2 days and it dropped it down to 4.5. I mean, hours earlier, even though you are more full and had more calories because you ate sabotage foods. So that shows you in your own body that I'm not making this stuff up, that your DNA is programmed to be eating fats and proteins. And when you eat these other foods, it makes you hungry sooner than you should be. You're not supposed to be hungry so soon. You already know that you did the other thing. So that's number one, to do that yourself so you can see it, because that helps you understand what these foods are doing and why so many people have problems. Then the other thing is, don't do anything in a hurry if a hurry is going to sabotage it. So I always tell people, remember that every step in the right direction, pat yourself on the back and say, yeah, I'm not perfect. None of us are perfect. And that was helpful. So if you could say every time you sit down that the amount of whatever starch you normally have, whether it's a rice or some kind of potatoes or corn, you simply cut that amount in half and add a little bit more of either a non-starch-based vegetable, broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus. I mean, there are lots of non-starchy vegetables, or a little bit more of the meat portion. Then that's an easy way to do it. And most people start noticing, sometimes the first 2 or 3 days, but most often at least within the first few weeks, that if they do that, if every meal the amount of starch-based food gets cut in half, and you're still having it, you can eliminate it if you want to, but you said, what do we do to make it easier? Cut it in half, because you're used to those foods, and increase, you know, the fats and the proteins, and if you want some non-starchy vegetables, bring those in. You will find that your energy level slowly starts to go up. You are no longer desiring snacks quite as much in between meals. And when, of course, when you get it correct, you'll never need snacks in between meals. And you just feel better. Some people's sleep gets better. A lot of people find they're more alert, that after the meal, it's not like an hour and a half and they have a hard time keeping their eyes open if they're taking a class, because the sabotage foods are what do that. And when you bring it down, it helps. And as you see the benefits, it's easier to make more of the changes.
Yeah, that's such a great point. It's one of the things I encourage my clients to do is journal. I have them do it for 4 to 7 days as well, just to get in touch with their bodies, just to pay attention. And it's very interesting. I found for myself just developing that awareness. You know, I used to be like a carb junkie, like a lot of people. I mean, I start my day, honestly, with a low-fat cinnamon Pop-Tart and a glass of skim milk, because I was brainwashed to think, well, we all know that sugar is bad, so it's low sugar, and that, you know, fat is bad, so it's low fat. And of course, I didn't feel good. But paying attention, just learning to pay attention to how your body really responds to foods, that's the motivator. Because when you start putting good food in, you feel good, and then you deviate a little bit, or you add more of the starches back in, you notice how crappy it makes you feel. And when you can make that connection, that's the key right there. That's what motivates you to eat cleaner and put more of the sustainable, you know, the foods that's going to sustain you and your body, more of that in, because you have that connection. Like, this just doesn't make me feel good.
And believe it or not, actually, you would believe it, it makes total sense. The only thing that I hear often from my patients is, you know, I've been eating this way, taking some of the supplements, I feel so much better. You know, the only complaint I have is that prior to changing over and getting your help and feeling better and addressing all my conditions, and I know I was eating really, really lousy, but prior to these changes, if I went out with a bunch of friends and, you know, we went to the bar and had some drinks, or I went to a party, or I went to, you know, a wedding or a bar mitzvah or whatever the heck it was, you know, or maybe somebody was celebrating their divorce, and I had a whole bunch of cake and cookies and all the things that you're saying and you've taught me are so bad for me, basically starches, sugars, and alcohols, the next day I would feel a little bit worse than normal and I'd be over it really fast. Now the next day I feel like absolute crap. Mm-hmm. And I go, good, because that's the reinforcement. Because what happens is very simple. Your body is so much cleaner that the distance that your feelings go from what you are now feeling during the day to the way you feel when you eat this is a much greater distance. You've brought yourself way further down, and the body smacks you and says, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. And so I say, thank you. I'm glad that happens, because that's the reinforcement to help you do it less. And very often the person will say, oh yeah, what I did last weekend at a wedding where, you know, they said, well, look, hey, my friend made this wedding cake. Please have some. I know you don't eat this stuff normally. And so I had a piece of wedding cake, you know, and I had a glass of wine, or maybe he or she toasted the wedding with some champagne. And they felt so bad the next day that they said, next time, I'm not going to let somebody who loves me make me feel like crap for a day and a half.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened with me with wine. I used to love my red wine, and I hadn't had it in about a year because I really cleaned up my diet significantly. And I was with some family. I was with my fiance. Actually, we were visiting his grandparents, and they bought a bottle of wine. I think it was organic. And I was like, oh, that's nice. You know, nice gesture. I had literally half a glass, a very small amount, probably like 3 or 4 ounces, and I had a hangover. And I was like, you know, I remember it so vividly because I was like, I'm done. It's just not worth feeling this way. And I had never made that connection because I used to drink socially on the weekends. You know, I did that for years, and it never hit me like that. So it's such a great feeling when you can clean up your body and really develop the awareness you're supposed to have. You're not supposed to feel good when you put alcohol. Like, it should make you feel really crappy. So this, that's all good. David, let's talk about a little bit more about the importance of having animal proteins in the diet. I've worked with a number of clients. I hear more and more people tell me that, you know, they're choosing either not to have meat or not to have animal products at all. So follow a vegetarian or a vegan diet. And, you know, as we just discussed, you know, we evolved eating meat and having animal fats. It's so key. Can you talk about some of the problems that can arise when we choose not to eat meat or animal products? And a lot of our listeners are women over 50, too. If you could kind of speak more specifically to them, you know, what are some of the things that can happen, especially to a woman in midlife, when she is not getting the proteins and fats that her body needs?
Well, the amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, so all proteins are made up of many different amino acids, those are what the body uses to rebuild tissue. And our tissue breaks down and rebuilds, you know, every day. Some break down, some rebuild. Those people who exercise, and the more somebody exercises, the more of their tissue they're breaking down every day, the more protein they need to rebuild it back up again. And they've also shown that higher protein people in general don't lose bone in the same way. So for bone loss, we want adequate protein. One of the big issues, which is very misunderstood, is we let science get in the way of facts. And we do this all the time. And so, for example, the Food and Nutrition Board will tell the public, you know, through doctors and dietitians, that, well, there's a certain group of amino acids, which again come from proteins, which are known to be and have been proven to be what we call essential. Mm-hmm. In nutritional biochemistry, the word essential is only used for things in the food area, that's vitamins, you know, are all essential, certain minerals are essential, certain fats are essential, and certain amino acids are essential. The word essential is not allowed to be used except for those foods which the body cannot manufacture from other things. So in other words, if there is an amino acid, of which there are a number, that your body can make from the essential amino acids, then that other amino acid or those other amino acids are not considered to be essential, because as long as you get the essential ones, you can make those. The problem is that your body doesn't always agree with the laboratory. And so any of a number of things, too much of this pollutant, that pollutant, pesticides, herbicides, heavy metals, all these different things that are in our bodies, making our bodies not be the perfection that they're supposed to be, also makes it so a lot of the things that we're supposed to be able to do, or our bodies are supposed to be able to do, they cannot do. And so because of that, it becomes more and more clear that if you want to make certain that all of the amino acids that your body needs to be able to rebuild, to be able to make bone, to be able to rebuild tissue, to be able to support your muscles, all the different things that you want, you need only to make sure that we're getting meats. Because meats, and again, remember I said meats, that's any kind of animal protein, the meats have all the amino acids in them. And so they have all of the essential amino acids that they agree are essential. And then they have all of the ones that they're not quite sure about, which are now called conditionally essential. And then they have all the ones which theoretically you can make from the others, but no, you can't because your body's not working correctly. And so all of them come in, whether you have eggs or beef or lamb or chicken or fish or turkey or rock cornish game hen or pheasant or elk or venison. And these are all things that, you know, that people eat. That way they're all coming in. Whereas if you try to do, let's say, food combining, where you have this grain, 75% starch, and this bean, another 75% starch, because those two together give you the essential amino acids, you are deficient in a whole bunch of amino acids, both because some of the ones that are not looked at as essential, you didn't get and you do need, and because all you need is a speck of one of these amino acids for the Food and Nutrition Board, who is pushing vegetarianism, to say, okay, it's in there. That's sort of like delivering all the supplies somebody needs to build a house, but you're going to give them only 5% of the amount of wood and 2% of the amount of nails. And when the contractor says, I can't build a house with this, the delivery truck says, I gave you everything you need to build a house. Yes, but not in adequate quantities. Mm-hmm. You only get adequate quantities for you to be able to rebuild muscle, for you to be able to make new bone, all the different things the body has to be doing with the animal-based amino acids. And the reason that a lot of this has been pushed out of the way and that we've been told opposite is because the proteins we eat are so poorly raised that they're wrong. So when you have corn-fed beef, which is what they tout in the restaurants, because therefore you can get these cattle up to the age and size to be able to be killed for our dinner plate in 9 months when you're giving them the most fattening food on the planet, grains and beans, whereas when they're grass feeding, instead of 9 months, you need 22 to 24 months. A huge difference, because grasses are not fattening. They grow at the proper speed, much more slowly, and everything is in there. And so the differences are so astonishing that we have a lot of research showing red meat is bad for you. No, the red meat we're eating is bad for us. It's got all the wrong fats in it. The amino acid content may even be different. I don't know. All the research is on fats. It grew much too fast. And more importantly, or equally importantly, we very, very often, depending on our own desires, overcook it to death. Obviously, if you go back in time far enough, we ate all this stuff raw because we didn't know how to make a fire yet. I'm not saying people shouldn't cook their food, but if you eat a rare lamb chop or a medium rare lamb chop or same thing with a piece of steak, you are much less damaging the foods that nature has provided for you in there, and your body has more of what it needs. So both what did the animal eat and are we overcooking it? But, I mean, there's no question. I see lots and lots of women that I have as my patients. They're in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they go, you know, I mean, I used to feel so much better when I was 25 or 35. And I go, good. How about we see if we can get that back in the next 6 months? And, you know, they smile and they go, well, I'll settle for half of it back. But very often 6 months later or 8 months later, they feel better than they did 10 years ago because we're bringing in everything the body was missing. And then we start working on detoxification to start pulling out the things that it wishes were not there that we're always exposed to in our marvelous industrialized world.
Can you kind of just reiterate what you were saying about the grains and the beans? Because I've heard this before. So, you know, you can combine them and you can create some of the essential fatty acids. Is that what you're saying? You can create some, but you're not getting the amount that you need. Is that right?
Sure. What I'm saying is that there are certain amino acids, building blocks of protein, certain amino acids, cysteine, methionine, which are more in one but not in the other, with the one and the other being either grains or beans. And so the vegans, vegetarians will push that, well, you need to have the essential amino acids, and so you have to have them both. You have to eat them both together so that we have the ones that are missing in one, we get in the other. Yes, that's true, but the amounts still don't come close to the amounts that would have been in animal-based proteins, which is what our body and our DNA was brought up with for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so, yes, if you analyzed it in a lab, you would be able to say, ah, look, all of the essential amino acids are in fact there, but just like giving somebody a tenth the amount of nails and screws to build a house, the house won't be built, even though, yes, they are there, the body feels the same way.
So not enough. And so just to reiterate here, like if someone is a vegetarian or vegan and they're eating a lot of beans, nuts, and seeds, they may be getting some essential amino acids, but they're not going to get what they need.
They're not going to get what the body would like. And if somebody really wants to look at that and doesn't mind spending some money, it's not cheap, there's a beautiful panel called the Cardio Ion. Ion is I-O-N. I believe it stands for Individual Optimized Nutrition. But the Cardio Ion panel from Metametrics Clinical Laboratories, there are some people that have copied it. I don't like the other tests as much. And they will take a look at like 20 or 30 of your amino acids and a bunch of essential fatty acids and vitamins and minerals. And it will show all the things that you are low in. And get ready to be surprised if you think you're eating really, really well and feel pretty good if you run a Cardio Ion panel on yourself and see how many things your body's low in.
Interesting. What about soy? You know, a lot of vegetarians and vegans will eat soy as, you know, a protein substitute. But you know, my understanding is that there's a lot of health risks. Obviously, one of the facts, the matter is that it's GMO, but there are a lot of other concerns around soy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There are a lot of concerns about soy, and there are people on both sides of that issue. And as far as I'm concerned, my personal opinion is the ones that believe soy is good for you simply are avoiding reading the research that would prove to them the opposite because they've been saying what they've been saying for so long. Best book on soy is called The Whole Soy Story by Kayla Daniel. And she goes over all of it beautifully. But basically, in a rather large nutshell, soy contains a whole bunch of chemicals which both prevent the proper breakdown and utilization of amino acids, of proteins. They're protease inhibitors. And so even if you have some soy, like a bunch of big cubes of tofu in a stew that also has some chicken, fish, or beef or lamb in it, they will also prevent your body from being able to access as well all of the other good proteins that are there. Number two, they are filled with chemicals that are looked at as plant-based hormones, phytoestrogens. And so they can often throw people's hormones way off. I've had a number of people where when we've pulled them off soy or we've pulled their young kids off soy, a whole bunch of hormonal imbalances went away. And even if you don't feel them, they're still happening. So I don't like soy. Apparently the only thing that can be done that seems to deactivate a lot of those problems is if the soy product has been correctly and adequately fermented. And so there is miso, which is a healthy food, which has been shown to be a healthy food, which is fermented soy. I like it. I like to know when I buy it, such as from Goldmine Natural Foods online, that it tells me this miso has been fermented 30 days, this is 60 days, this is a year and a half, much more expensive, as opposed to the ones you get in the store where nowhere on the label does it even tell you it's been fermented. It just calls it miso. So I'm not sure if they found some other process to do it instead of fermentation. I want to know that it's been fermented for at least 30 days. So miso is a fermented soy. Tempeh, T-E-M-P-E-H, is a fermented soy. I don't like it. It has no flavor, but it is a fermented soy. Natto is a very healthy fermented soy that is about one of the most foul-tasting foods I've ever had in my life. But it's very good for you because it contains nattokinase, which is an enzyme that keeps your blood flowing well. And all of the tofu that is available in health food stores is not fermented. They put a chemical in it and precipitate it. Whereas Chinese original tofu, which the health food stores do not carry, which you would have to go to an Asian market, it will not be refrigerated because it doesn't require it. It will be in small glass bottles, and it gets one of the other names for tofu because tofu has three names. It's called tofu, it's called bean curd, and it's called soy cheese. And it will say fermented bean curd, product of China. So if somebody wanted tofu, you can get fermented tofu in glass bottles in an Asian market. But there isn't any reason for any of those, with the exception of some research that shows that miso actually may be good for you. And so we actually do use miso in this household. We buy miso from companies where I know how long it's been fermented, and we use it in a lot of our foods.
Interesting. I've never had – I pretty much like cut all soy from my diet, but I'll have to try miso.
The mildest tasting miso, the ones that more people go, oh, that's okay, is called shiro, S-H-I-R-O, or white miso. It's milder tasting. There will be a lot of salt taste to it. So I tell people, salt your stew by adding miso to it. And then after you've added a few tablespoons of miso, if it still needs more salt, go ahead and put in a good quality sea salt. But don't put the miso in after you've already salted it. You'll make it too salty for you.
Okay, good to know. You know, you said something interesting about the phytoestrogens in soy. I had a client a number of years ago who said that she had followed one of those sort of fad soy-based diet years ago to lose weight. And she said, you know, I did actually lose a little bit of weight, but she ended up going into menopause very, very early. Is that, do you think that there's a connection there?
It's certainly possible. You know, it's always hard to know what really caused something in an individual person. We have a condition in a lot of children that, you know, around the world called precocious puberty. And that's when boys or girls develop their sex organs way sooner than we used to a long time ago. Now, of course, we already do that way sooner than we did a long time ago just because of the amount of hormones or hormone mimics that are in our environment, because pesticides, herbicides, fungicides all have estrogenic effects. Plasticizers that leach out of plastic into our food have estrogenic effects. Soy has phytoestrogens, have estrogenic effects. So they believe that the precocious puberty is totally being caused by all these different things. Of course, everybody likes to be able to point whatever they don't like. So the major anti-soy people will say soy is causing this. The anti-hormones in our beef and chickens and everything will say, no, it's the hormones that are in all of our foods are causing this. The anti-pesticide people will say, no, it's the hormonal effects of all the pesticides. Well, we don't know whether it's a combination of all three or more one or more the other, because we don't have any parts of the planet that only have one or the other or a different one that we can take a look at. You know, you'd need a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. But we do know that kids are reaching puberty way earlier than they were 100 years ago. That's all of them. And that some of them are reaching it so early that we give it a disease name and call it precocious puberty. And then we have specific natural compounds, such as the compounds that are in brassica vegetables, diindolmethane, D-I-M, which help the body rid itself of excess estrogens, another one called calcium deglucurate. And we can sometimes turn off precocious puberty if it's found early by bringing these things in that help the body eliminate the excess estrogens while putting the child on an organic diet, knocking out soy, making sure that the meat they eat is grass-fed and hormone-free, et cetera, et cetera.
Pretty amazing how when you feed the body what it's meant to, you know, be fed on, the nutrients that it needs, how you can reverse a lot of health issues.
It is completely amazing. As a matter of fact, I have people that get upset when I'm going over the Pottinger cat trials, because I'm the vice president of the original Price Pottinger Nutrition Foundation, which has always been in California. And we keep alive all the works of Dr. Price and Dr. Pottinger. And Pottinger had a book that he wrote, which we keep in print, called Pottinger's Cats, A Study in Nutrition. And he found that if you had cats that were on a diet which was not species specifically correct for cats, in other words, you were giving them cooked meats, you were giving them things that they would never normally eat themselves if they're killing animals and eating them, you would very quickly start having different kinds of problems, emotional problems like we have today, infertility when it got bad enough, you would have the fur starting to come off, skin problems. They would be fighting amongst themselves instead of playing naturally, all the various different things that we see in humans. But that if before they lost fertility, which varied between the males and the females as far as how many generations it took, but by four generations they were all infertile. But if you grab the ones that were still able to reproduce and put them back on a perfect diet, it took five generations, and to me this is fascinating, before perfection and health came back. In other words, it all came back. Somehow or other, the DNA, RNA, or whatever other energies in our bodies we have yet to discover knew what they were supposed to do. And when you gave them everything perfectly, they slowly went back, with each generation, succeeding generation, being better. I would say that, and then people will go, well, wait a minute, you're saying that if I can't, that maybe my great-great-great-great-grandkids can be healthier, but I can't improve my health? That's a little like, oh, so why am I in this class? But thankfully, even though we can't get rid of everything, we can't make the heart disease and the cancer, we can't make it so that as you get older, you won't need reading glasses or you won't need contacts. You know, that would take multiple generations. We can make massive improvements in people's health, very often extremely noticeable in just a few months and continuing to get better and better and better. And every once in a while, maybe once every few years, I'll get a phone call from a patient I haven't seen in a long time. They're still in San Diego doing real well. They moved out of state and they just said, I wanted to call you or email you because I remember you told me that if I continue to eat well, take the supplements, they're doing everything, get the better foods, that I'm going to have more changes than I've even had in this first 2 years that I worked with you in person. And I just want to let you know, it's now been like 4, 5, 6 years. I haven't even seen you, and I'm still noticing improvements in my health. Sure, because it took them, depending on their age, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years to get to where they are.
Right.
And anybody thinks that eating really well can reverse that in a couple of years? No way.
Right.
But you can make massive inroads that are really, really nice to see.
Yeah, that, and that's sort of the message that we want to really emphasize with our listeners, because, you know, many of them are in their 50s and 60s, and, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, because as you just said, it's many years of, you know, poor habits that have gotten to this point. But the good news is it really doesn't take nearly as long to start reversing things. I mean, I have clients telling me within the first week of making changes, you know, they feel better. So that's the, you know, the good news there.
Yes, and that is very good news because, again, starches, sugars, and alcohols are so strongly forcing us in the wrong direction that even if somebody says, all right, I don't know whether I'm going to do this or not, but I'm going to do an experiment, and for 2 weeks I'm going to forego 100% starch-based foods, foods that taste sweet, and any alcohol, just for 2 weeks. And let me go online and learn a couple things so I make sure I understand what starch is and what foods might be starchy that I don't know about. For example, nuts are not looked at as being starchy, but cashews are very high starch.
Mm-hmm.
And chestnuts are almost pure starch. Other than those two, the others are fine. And they just do it for 2 weeks and they go, wow, this is really amazing. I can think better. I'm not as tired during the day. I have more energy. I like this. And then very often, you know, people get interested and they go, are there some books I can read? And I go, geez, there are dozens and dozens of books you can read. And so somebody will say, well, give me two books to read. And the two books that I often give people are Good Calories, Bad Calories by Gary Taubes. And he also has a number of great YouTube videos on the truth about cholesterol. And The Primal Blueprint by Mark Sisson. They're very, very different books. They'll give you very, very different information. But you'll learn a lot of good things.
Awesome. Yeah, those are great resources for people that are listening that are kind of like, I want more information, not sure where to start. Can you speak a little bit about dairy?
Sure.
You know, you talked about like fish and chicken and, you know, grass-fed lamb and beef. Is that, can we talk about, you know, whether that's a good source of, you know, proteins and fats, and then obviously the quality of the dairy? Does that
play
a factor?
Absolutely. Dairy is an interesting food because the public has been taught by a lot of health practitioners that it's very bad for us, number one, that no animal would ever drink dairy after it's weaned, number two, and that, you know, they certainly wouldn't drink it from another species, number three, and that it's mucus producing, number four. And so let's dispel those myths. First of all, if somebody's allergic to cats, every time they go into the house with cats, you know, or dogs or horse or whatever, I don't care what, or dust mites or mold, they get all snuffed up, you know, or their nose starts running, whatever it might be. Obviously, for that person, cats are mucus producing, or dogs are mucus producing, which really is an incorrect word. It's allergenic. So the question is not whether or not dairy is mucus producing. The question is, are lots of people reactive to milk? And the answer is yes. A lot of people react to milk, varying different ways. Some of them are reacting because they are unable to digest milk sugar, which is lactose, because the lactase enzyme their body doesn't produce enough of, and in some people that produces mucus and causes a seemingly allergic reaction. In somebody else, it's not the lactose. In somebody else, it's all the crazy things that have happened to milk when we cook it, because, of course, you're buying cooked milk in the store. You're not buying milk. You're buying cooked milk. I mean, if you went over to the produce aisle and you were trying to get some broccoli, cauliflower, and lettuce and asparagus, and all they had was all of those cooked, you might go, okay, I'm going to another store. And yet you go to buy milk, and you're getting cooked milk. So we'll cover that a little bit. So a lot of people are reactive to what we call milk. And what we call milk is not really milk. Originally, of course, cows were out in a green pasture, and they were eating grass and weeds, and they were being milked. And the milk, before we had refrigeration, of course, would usually be drunk within a couple of days. But if it wasn't consumed within a couple of days, all of the Acidophilus and Bifidus, which are the resident bacteria in good quality grass-fed raw milk, will start to eat up the sugar, same way they do in yogurt, and they would lacto-ferment the milk. And so after a couple of days of no refrigeration, it would start becoming sour. Nobody would throw the milk out, because sour milk is actually healthier for you than regular milk, as long as it hasn't been heated and the cows are eating grass, because the reason it's turned sour is the same reason your yogurt turns sour. The Acidophilus and Bifidus, which are both good for you and you pay extra for them in your yogurt, they were gobbling up all the milk sugar. So I get raw milk only from grass-fed cows. In California, we have two brands. One of them is Organic Pastures. That's run by Mark McAfee. He does a lot of research and is always trying to educate people on milk. The other is Claravale, and that's owned by the Garthway family. And those are both raw grass-fed milks. And if I happen to keep it in the refrigerator for so long, because I'm out of town at a conference, that it starts to turn sour, I'm certainly not going to throw it out. I'd be throwing out extra Acidophilus and Bifidus. That's what I buy in yogurt. So I will simply throw it into a smoothie, add a little bit of stevia to it, and continue to make my smoothie. So if you have access to grass-fed, preferably organic, but they don't usually spray a bunch of sprays and garbage on milk, on grass that's going to be fed to cows. The cows are going to eat it anyway. They don't care what's sprayed on it, so they just don't bother. But grass-fed raw dairy, preferably from cows that get, checked for diseases, that's very healthy, and very few people have any reaction. So milk is not mucus producing, but you may react to the cooked milk we get. So we get that one out of the way. Number two, the reason that milk has caused some different other problems in people is because if you don't feed the cows grass, which is their species-specific diet, if you don't do that, if you give them corn instead, then you end up with E. coli and staph and strep and other different things in the milk, because they're not getting the food they should be for the animal to be healthy. And when the animal is not healthy, the milk it produces is much more liable to have things in it that shouldn't be there. And so now, of course, they have to pasteurize the milk, but they don't filter it. So now if, by chance, it was a batch of milk that had a bunch of some bad bacteria in it, and it just depends on the milk, now you're eating all those dead bacteria because they're still there. And we know from mold, you can kill mold and the mold is still reactive to you. So a lot of people react because of the quality of the garbage, cooked, et cetera, milk. And if you can get the grass-fed raw again, that problem goes away. Although if you happen to be reactive even to raw milk, that's fine. We can be reactive to anything. Now we have no animal would ever drink milk after it's weaned. I have a big problem with that. Every time somebody says that, I say, so let me get this straight now. You're saying that if we do something that no other animal on the planet Earth would do, it's probably not a good idea. And the person will, shake their head up and down and say, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. So in other words, additional knowledge that the humans have because of having a bigger brain and better reasoning capabilities should not be used. So what you're saying is we have to immediately work to get rid of, in any way we possibly can, make these things go away because no other animal does them. We have to get rid of electricity. We have to get rid of houses. We have to get rid of automobiles. We have to get rid of clothing. We have to get rid of the glass and windows. We have to get rid of all of our steel structures. We have to get rid of our airplanes. You're not allowed to have a bicycle. And all of a sudden, they realize that the idea that no other animal can do something might possibly not be a good argument for why we shouldn't do something. So I get that one. That one's gone. And then the other leftover is interspecies nursing. And somebody will say, obviously, if you were to have any animal nurse on another species' milk, it has to be bad for them. You know, it's not what they were supposed to get. And so that, I mean, no animal would drink another species' milk. And if they did, you know, it would probably make them very sick and it might kill them. And so in my class, I have collected some of the best interspecies nursing videos that have been put up on the web. And if you go into Google and you just put in interspecies nursing, you should be able to get some of them, where a dog was nursing a bunch of kittens, and did so until they didn't need it anymore, and they were very healthy, and they did just great, where a lion was nursing a monkey, where a, oh my, there were so many different ones, I can't even remember them all, but it's fascinating, and they're actually fun videos. So go put in interspecies nursing, you will find out that it didn't cause any problems, that they, actually helped keep these different animals alive because, you know, the kittens were found and mom wasn't there, and the dog had just given birth. But they'd taken the puppies away to give away, and so the dog was more than happy to nurse the kittens. So it's really, really, all of those different things having to do with dairy are all nonsense. But dairy is only a healthy food if, just like I said about other things, if the cattle are out there, if the cows are out there in green pastures, in sun, eating grass, and if we leave the milk raw after testing it to make sure that the animals are healthy. And I drink an average of 6 to 7 gallons of grass-fed, raw, whole milk per 3-week period. And the reason I know it so well for that amount is because although we have really high quality milk in California from Claravale and organic pastures, there are some dairies back in Pennsylvania that are run by the Amish, where they have a species of cattle that produces a little bit more butterfat than some of the ones here. And more importantly, because land is less expensive, they've got so much land and so much more rain than we have in California, they can afford to have them all grass-fed. And so even after paying the shipping charges for the refrigerated tractor trailer that comes across the country every 3 weeks, it costs me less to buy a gallon of whole raw milk from the Amish, about $10, than it would cost me to buy the same gallon of locally raised stuff, about $16. And so I end up getting that. Plus, in the United States, in order for milk to be called whole, and I think this may vary a little bit from state to state, it has to have a butterfat content of between, I believe it's 3.25% and 3.5% butterfat. That's why the lower fat is, you know, 2% and 1% and non-fat. But whole milk is 3.25% to 3.5% butterfat. The stuff I get from the Amish with these cows and the amount of grass they get is between 6% and 7.5% and sometimes even 8% butterfat. So I'm almost drinking light cream. And it has not affected my weight at all. I am still slim. And because when I order my 6 gallons, when the next delivery comes in 3 weeks later, I am either just finishing the last gallon or I've already had to go to the store and buy a seventh. I know that I'm drinking 6 to 7 gallons every 3 weeks of double whole fat milk.
Yeah, it's interesting how you talk about how, you know, the quality of the milk you're drinking can impact your reaction to it. Because I know, like, I used to have, like, when I was in my 20s, I developed, like, a weird sensitivity to it. Of course, I was drinking the pasteurized, homogenized. It was conventional, so who knows what those animals were being fed. And, you know, they were probably pumped with hormones and antibiotics. But I would get, like, this weird rash on my neck. So I stopped, you know, consuming dairy. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to try some raw milk. And raw milk actually just became legal here in New Hampshire just a few years ago. I actually used to have to go to a farm, which was like way out of my way. It was like 20 minutes away. So it was like 45 minutes out of my day just to go get, you know, a gallon of milk. But what was interesting is that I did not respond negatively at all. Like, my body loved it. I felt so good consuming it. So I think that's a really important message that, you know, I've consulted with clients that I have issues with dairy, and the question is, you know, is it the milk sugar, is it truly a lactose issue, or is it the processing? Because I know for me, it had to do with the processing, and I don't know what it was about the processing, because there's so many things that are going on, but it's two very, very different products.
It is absolutely two very, very different products. And there's a video online at YouTube if they haven't pulled it off. Every time I see a video that I really like, I immediately record it onto my computer. So if they happen to pull it off, I can still have it. But go onto YouTube and everybody search Fox News Monsanto. That should bring it up. See if that'll do it. Fox News Monsanto. And there were a couple of people in Fox News that wanted to do a special on all the recombinant bovine gonadotrophic hormones and other garbage being put into milk. And they were all ready to do it when Monsanto contacted the Fox News people and threatened to sue them if they did it, and it never happened. And the two reporters were so upset with having all of this stuff kicked out when it was good news that they, after they got fired, because they weren't going to just leave, they said, no, we have to do this. They did a beautiful video and put it up on YouTube on the entire state of affairs of what happened and how it went and Monsanto and everything. And you should be able to find it by Fox News Monsanto or Fox News RBGH Milk. One of those two should find you the video. You need to watch this video.
Interesting. Okay. I've written it down. I'm going to check it out. You were saying too before you get your milk from organic pastures. I just interviewed Mark McAfee, so he was a riot.
I love Mark. Mark is a fabulous man. We've had him at the Price Pottinger Foundation here in San Diego. I love what he's doing to promote all of the benefits and to dispel all the myths about raw milk. He's a good man and he's doing the right things.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be on our show in a future episode because I just interviewed him, so he was
excellent.
Just to kind of go back to what we were talking about before, David, about the issues with vegetarianism and veganism. You know, if someone is listening and they're like, oh, I'm hearing what you're saying, of the nutritional benefit, but a lot of times, like, I hear people have reservations about eating meat or animal products for more like moral ethical reasons. So, for example, it might be like an environmental concern, or they might be concerned about the treatment of animals, what's going on conventional farms, or maybe they don't promote the killing of animals. What do you say to someone whose reason for not eating meat or animal products altogether is more of a moral ethical one? And it's not that they think that it's nutritionally bad, but that's sort of the place they're coming from.
Well, that's come up so many times that it's something I specifically cover. And the easiest way for me to get my point across, and they may have a different thing than what I'm about to say, but this is the way I do it, is I ask the following question. Who would you think is more respectful of nature, of our plants and animals, of the planet Earth in general, of whatever words you want to use to say we need to respect all this? You, and I might be talking to a vegetarian or a vegan, or maybe you don't do it as strictly as you think you should, maybe some friend of yours, or maybe some group, something like that, or the traditional tribal populations, most of which are now extinct, on this planet, all of the various different American Indian tribes before we, commercialized them, the New Zealand Maori, the various tribal populations in Africa. Which do you think would be more respectful and like the perfect example of what you would want to be? Those traditional populations back then or some group now? And so far, there's been no hesitation. Every single person I have ever said this to has said, we will never be able to get as good at respecting our planet, as being nice to nature and everything, as those traditional populations. I say, good, then we can agree on that. Do you understand that not a single one of them were ever vegetarian? They all killed animals, and they gave thanks to their gods, their spirits, their whatever you want to call them, for giving us a good hunt, to give us the animals, to keep our population and our tribe healthy. So we dispel that idea.
A good take-home message.
I mean, the question is, and I don't care whether somebody is spiritual or religious, believes in one God, many gods, believes that we're all part of God, believes there isn't a God. It doesn't make any difference. The point is that every animal out there except the few that are vegetarian, and there are vegetarian animals, and those that are truly vegetarian can eat, you know, can graze all day and be in perfect health for multiple generations. That's fine. You know, we can't. But every other animal, all the animals that are not vegetarian, they kill whatever various different types of animals are their prey, which in turn may be another non-vegetarian animal that's killing another prey. And would somebody want to make the earth pretty much unlivable by preventing every animal from getting its prey and feeding it something that it shouldn't eat until they all go away and we're really destroying nature? Or is nature allowed to exist and do what it's supposed to do, but for some reason, once again, you know, just like I said about us learning to be able to use cars and electricity, that humans should be the only animal on the planet that, because of our who knows what, are no longer going to eat the healthiest food to keep us multi-generationally healthy because somebody wants us to be vegan. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. What's one final take-home message that you want our listeners to have? I mean, we've talked about so much today, but is there anything else that you want our listeners to know or understand?
Well, I always say that the most important trilogy of gaining more health, bringing back your health, or continuing your health are a combination of eating foods as much healthier than you do now as possible, bringing in all the things that we've talked about and things we haven't about healthy eating. Number two, detoxification, which is learning where the different poisons are in your environment, and your different solvents and cleaners and stuff in your house and your toothpaste and your shampoos and everything, and trying to find the ones that have no poisons in them to add to your body every day, and then of course working on getting extra poisons out of your body, and bringing in the nutritional supplements that we simply don't have enough of these nutrients anymore in our food because we're under so much more stress, we're around so many more poisons, that even eating perfectly, unless maybe you were brought up and raised to adulthood in the rainforest, even eating perfectly, you don't have enough of everything. So people need to look at changing their diet as much as they're willing, and hopefully as you see improvements, you end up doing more. Slowly learning where the different toxins are in the things in your environment. In my website, one of the buttons on being healthy or something, there's a 2 or 3 page handout on specific products that I found. I have nothing to do with any of them. They're just the ones I found are clean. So if somebody wants good shampoos and good conditioners and good body lotions and whatever, they're on that list. And learning enough about supplements to bring in some of the things that will help because we don't get enough in food. And forget about these people out there that saying things like a multivitamin is going to shorten your life. I could go over for an hour on what was faulty about that research. But all of those things are important, and stress is also important. And anything you can do to reduce your stress level is going to improve your life. And people don't think about that, and I don't care what it is. For one person, reducing your stress level is blobbing back and watching a TV program at the end of the day instead of doing something that you think you should be more doing because I'm wasting time. No, if that's helpful for you, then in reducing stress, somebody else will do some meditation, somebody else will do a directed visualization, anything that you can do that will reduce your stress. When people take vacations, very often they come back and they tell me, oh yeah, we spent a day here, and a day here, and a day here, and 2 days here, and a day here. And I go, wow, I couldn't do that. That wouldn't be a vacation. And they actually did a study on vacations many, many years ago, and they found that in order for a vacation to reduce the person's stress level, you had to remain in the same base place for over a week. Which is why when I take a 2 week vacation, we go to one place, and that's our home base, and we'll drive out to different places every day because the relaxation of knowing where you're going at the end of the day and not moving again and moving again and moving again makes it more of a vacation. And to me, it's for relaxation.
Yeah, the stress is, we talked a lot about nutrition, but boy, stress is so overlooked, and it really is. And I think that unless you manage it well, it's very difficult to make the dietary changes.
Yes.
So it's so important. And I like what you said about being willing, you know, as much as you're willing to do. I always like encourage my clients to start with maybe 3 to 4 changes at once, because sometimes the overwhelm, just the idea of change, of, you know, what needs to change, that in and of itself can stop someone from even getting started.
Yep.
So, you know, you make 1 or 2 changes and then success breeds success. You start to feel better and you want to keep building on that. So that's a really, really great message there. Well, thank you so much, David. This has been another fabulous interview. You never disappoint ever. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
You're very, very, very welcome. Look forward to next time.
Yeah. So for anyone who wants to learn more about David, his programs, his services, he does some one-on-one consulting, so I encourage you to reach out to him. Go to naturopathforyou.com. That is NaturoPath, 4YOU.com. You can also just type in David Getoff, GETOFF. You'll find lots of great stuff about David. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Better Beyond 50. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe on betterbeyond50.com, iTunes, the podcast app, or wherever else you might be listening to this show. And if you have a minute, please leave me a quick review on iTunes. I always love to hear from you. If you think someone else might like this free show, take a minute to share it with a friend or family member so she can benefit from it too. And don't forget to sign up for my free video training and newsletter. Again, just enter your email at betterbeyond50.com to get instant access and make sure you never miss a future show. This is Melissa Kerner signing off, and thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a fantastic week. Talk to you soon.